16 and 17 in Genesis are two chapters that I want us to look at tonight. 16 and 17, neither one are very long. And so we'll take time to read 16 here in just a moment to kind of freshen our minds. Hopefully you've already read 16 and 17 for tonight. They're very interesting, and I think there's some very long-reaching things in 16 and 17 that I think you'll find interesting that will come back to either haunt the children of Israel in the future or make some really good application lessons for us as well. So we're into this character of Abram and his wife Sarai. And who would like to read chapter 16? There's 15 verses, and we just want to read through them quickly and get them in our minds. Who would read the chapter? Go ahead, Jesse. Chapter 16.
Now, three, Abram's wife bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian whose name was Hagar. And
you said Sarai?
Sarai.
Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid, that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar and made the Egyptian after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleases thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hand. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And she called the name of the Lord that spoke unto her, thou God, seest me. For she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old, and Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram.
Thank you, Jesse. You know, what's your impression when you read this chapter? Different ways to approach it, perhaps, from different people's perspective that are written about in this chapter. Let me ask you a question. Who's the innocent party in this chapter? Who's innocent? And what we read about and what happened here? True, because he's not born yet. We'll run into the problems with Ishmael in 17 and 18 later on. Among the adults. Anybody innocent? I think I could throw a rock at any of them. All right? And what's good about that? Kind of makes them like you and me, doesn't it? You can throw a rock at me on just about any subject you want to, and at one point it would hit me on just about anything. And so I make that point and make this point as we read through these chapters. Understand, again, God is telling this story for us to understand that these are real people. They're not perfect. And as we read through specifically this character of and the character surrounding Abraham, or yet to be named Abraham, Abram, we're going to see growth. We're going to see progression and perfection being attained and growing toward by him, by Sarah, or Sarai at this point also. And God gives them time to grow into that. Aren't you glad that God gives us time to grow? That when we become a Christian, look at what little you knew compared to what you know now. That spiritual growth that has occurred or should be occurring makes you better at being a disciple. I remember when I turned 16 years old, I started taking flying lessons. I got my flying license almost faster than I got my driver's license. I'd spend every Saturday, I'd work during the week at Long John Silver's as a fry cook, or at JCPenney selling sporting goods or suits in men's department all through high school. Those were my jobs in high school. Worked 20, 30 hours a week. And I'd spend all my money on Saturdays at the airport. And I was a hangar rat. I'd go over there and I'd hang out at Bowman Field in Louisville, Kentucky, right off the Waterson. And I'd get permission from my parents to go, and I'd be over there most of the day. And I'd take a flying lesson. I'd save up my money. It was $17 an hour to rent the airplane wet, which meant the gas came with it. So anyway, I got my license. I passed my student written test with a 72. 70 was passing. My instructor said, "You wasted 2 points." And so I was then able to fly anywhere I wanted to in the United States as a student pilot by myself in certain conditions. Daytime, nobody could go with me, it had to be pretty weather, but I was not limited in where I could go, only with the amount of time that they would rent the airplane to me, and they were most happy to rent to me for $17 an hour. And so I flew all over Indiana and Kentucky, and I mean, I flew into a lot of airports in Kentucky on Saturdays. Whatever I could get to in a couple hours, get out, have a Coke, walk around, get in the airplane and fly back. I didn't know anything about flying when I got that license. It's scary how little I knew, and yet did not kill myself. I didn't realize that until later on, when in college, I transferred to an aeronautical university. And for the first time in my life, when I was about 19 years old, I started getting professional training from what I would call a real pilot, and at that time, there were a lot of layoffs in the airlines like there are right now. And all these guys were furloughed, and I had an airline captain from TWA, 727 captain, who had got a job at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University as an instructor. So I had the best of the best sitting right next to me and teach me, and that's when I knew how little I knew. I say all that lesson to say, sometimes you start out at a place and you think you know everything you need, and then at some point you realize how little you know. And then you look back a few years later and you go, how far have I come? But by the grace of God, I'm still alive, that I live through that. I think we see some of that in Abram's life experience that's being shared here through these chapters. Abram is growing. Where he started when he was called is not where he ends up. And this chapter is not one of Abraham's or Abram's glowing chapters. we don't see in chapter 16 the great man of faith in this particular chapter. He's absent. The individual's there, but that characteristic is not shining forth brightly as the leader within his home. Okay? Just some thoughts for us to think about. You know, Sarah seems very vindictive. She's vindictive. She's vindictive at Abram. She's vindictive at Hagar. And Hagar is scornful. And we'll talk a little bit more about what she went through in this chapter. And the angel, when he finds her after she flees Sarai, the angel comes to Hagar and he tells her she has to do what? Go back to that scornful master you have and serve her. That was Hagar's plot, her plight in this chapter. And then we see Abram. You know, I can almost feel sorry for Abram in this situation. Because he's, you know, when you got two women in the house and they're at each other in the tent, not house, you know, but he kind of deserves what happened here. And it's of their own creation, okay? And it's oftentimes like we have to deal with the messes we make. And sometimes the effects are years into the future before they come back to haunt us. Okay, you know, Abraham was in chapter 14, we saw Abram as this righteous warrior, didn't we? You know, saving Lot, defeating the kings, coming back. And then he has this mountain peak of an experience with Melchizedek and the king of Sodom. And what does he tell the king of Sodom? Just last week we talked about this. King of Sodom says what? Let's divvy up. Thank you for all the saving that you've done. Let's divvy up the spoils and you can have all of this. Just give me the people back and you can keep all the riches. And what does he say to Sodom, king of Sodom? No, no. I won't take a single thing except the payment for my men. I don't want one thing from you, king of Sodom, you wicked king, because I don't want any strings attached to the wealth that God has given me and the blessings God has given me in my life that somebody can say, including you, that I got that because of what you did for me. So this mountain peak experience of Abraham and offering sacrifices with Melchizedek to the Lord and all of that is in 14. And then we see what happens here in 16. How did he get from that mountaintop to this kind of this valley experience? This is an ugly chapter in some ways because we see men treating men not well. This chapter is a problem that initially at its base is caused by slavery. Isn't it? Hagar is a slave. She came 10 years ago, more than likely, out of Egypt from the Pharaoh there, who, remember, bestowed upon Sarai and Abraham all of these blessings and all of these riches and treasures and sent them on their way with that lying episode about her being Abram's sister and not his wife. So he wants to take Sarai as his wife. He finds out, wait a minute, she's already married to you? You need to leave. Take all these things and take all your possessions and just go before God rains down upon us even more plagues. Remember, they got plagues, but he was fearful that all of that would continue or get worse, and so he sends them on their way. More than likely, this is where Hagar entered the household of Abram, because it says here very specifically, Hagar the who? The Egyptian. Well, they'd been living in Egypt. How did Hagar get connected to Abram and Sarai as Sarah's slave? From Pharaoh. It makes sense, right? So, and that's 10 years ago from what we're reading here. Okay? It says so. 10 years have gone by. and Hagar is a slave to Sarai. Now, what does Sarai know that's been happening already a few times we've read between God and Abram? What has been promised?
Offspring.
What else? You're going to have a son, right? Or through your descendants. Going to make of you a mighty nation. What else? The land. And we talked a lot about that. And Abraham's been told, walk around through the land. Everything you see from this river to that river, yours and your descendants, rather, are going to possess this. And so we see that Sarai knows this. Sarah knows this. And so that's Sarah's position coming into this chapter. Now let's talk about Hagar for a minute, the Egyptian slave girl. Her entering into the household through slavery and Abraham accepting that. He could have done what he did and was willing to do with the king of Sodom. But he didn't do that with Pharaoh, did he? Does that represent growth in Abram from the time of Pharaoh to what he did with the king of Sodom? Possibly. Probably. Not a good decision, because it's going to come back into this chapter and start to show how this is going to create problems for Abram. Him accepting Hagar as a slave 10 years before is going to cause problems for him now. But what he did with the king of Sodom was a totally different answer, wasn't it? So Abram's growing. God gives us time to grow. That's a good lesson for me to learn, right? On day one I became a Christian, I was not perfect. But on day one, God started perfecting me as I progressed. You understand the difference between progression and perfection? I think a lot of times we think that we have to provide our own perfection. And what rabbit hole does that take us down? A works-based theology and faith. And it leaves grace out of the picture. God had grace for Abram and Sarai too. But Hagar's situation here, did Hagar want to get pregnant? Did Hagar want this situation? No. Why do you think she was scornful towards Sarai, her master? She forced her to go in and lay with her husband. That's the ugliness of slavery. We don't like to think about that, but that's what happened here. Sarai took Hagar and gave her to Abraham as a wife. Did Hagar have any say in that? Not one word. She's a slave. And now she's pregnant. How degrading. Look at the circumstances surrounding Ishmael's conception and soon to be Isaac's conception with Abraham and Sarah. What a vast difference between these two, right? And so, this thing about slavery involved here is ugly. People can reap consequences of sin in very unusual and distant ways. It may be a long time before a sin will manifest itself in an ugly way. But many, many times, it will. And so, Sarah, or Hagar rather, despises Sarai. And after this happens, she has served Sarai for 10 years, and now this happens. And now the relationship between those two change, don't they? Because it doesn't seem to be that Sarai was vindictive before the conception, does it? Now Sarai has no mountaintop moment here either, right? Now she's making bad decisions and acting badly. Sarai becomes vindictive about Hagar's scornfulness toward her. How dare my slave treat me this way? And she goes and blames who? It's almost like this Garden of Eden thing all over again. You know, when God said, "Where are you, Adam?" And Adam goes, "This woman you gave me made me sin." And Eve goes, "This serpent over here that you created." Of course, God didn't create Satan in that sense, but she's pointing and blaming somebody else too. And so now Sarai goes to Abram and she blames him. God, choose between you and me about this mess. Well, that kind of indicates that Abram had something to do with the introduction of Hagar into this situation 10 years before. So that's all what's on the table here. And so Hagar had every right to despise Sarah and leave because of the abuse, right? She had a right to leave. She had a right to run away. Yes. We have passages in the New Testament that talk about this, don't we? About being content in the situation that you are in when you become a disciple. Right? And this idea of submission. Submission is real easy when they ask you to do something you want to do. But that's not really submission, is it? When does submission come into play? When you're asked to do something you don't want to do, and then you do it. And so Hagar, as we read, fled the situation. She had to look after her own self, right? No. No one else cared about her, right? Absolutely not. Because God cared about her. And the angel came in the latter part of this chapter and comes to Hagar and tells her that she needs to return. And then gives her this wonderful blessing to her on behalf of Ishmael and what's Ishmael's future going to be like. Now, Sarai here has put in place a solution to God's promises that have been going to Abram. This idea of a descendant, right? So I call this the Sarai solution. The Sarai solution to God sending them a child. Sarai does what? "Hey, Lord, I solved your problem. I can't have a child because I'm 90. So here's my solution, and I've already put it in place. Got my handmaid over here, got my slave. I've given her to my husband. They're having a child. This child will be the one to solve your problem, Lord." This is a summary of what Sarah, in essence, has done here. "Here you go, Lord. Here's my worship. Here's the way I'm going to work things out. It's the best I can come up with." Now, application for us. Do we ever do that with our worship? Do we ever do that? I think sometimes I have. "Look, Lord, I got this much time, but no more. I got this much energy, but no more. I got this much ability, but no more." We just expect the Lord to accept it. We kind of take that idea of New Testament Christianity tenet of free will offering, and then we set the scale of what that gets to look like. We don't get to do that because it's not our plan. Whose plan is it? See, God's already got a plan. And Sarah's over here trying to pull knobs and levers and things inside that plan. God's already put a plan in place back when. Before the creation of the world, God put a plan together to solve all of this and unfold all of this. And here's Sarah thinking she can just put her solution in place. We've already seen where Abram thought he had a plan with a manservant. So Sarah's solution is put in place with this child Ishmael here in chapter 16. All right. Let me see if I can advance this one more. Here are a couple of points. A main point from chapter 16. When God makes a promise, he keeps it. What is the promise God has made here to Abram? It's actually at the end of 15 is the most recent iteration of it. What has God told Abram? He's going to do what for you? I'm going to make of you, your descendants, a mighty nation. And now, at the end of 16, we now see, in the beginning of 17, actually, we now see the next time the Lord comes to Abram and makes that same promise again, there's a little difference in it. Instead of saying, I'm going to make of your descendants a great nation, what does he say to him now? I'm going to make of you a multitude of peoples. In other words, many nations. Because now God has promised Abram to take care and bless his descendants, and now there's a new descendant in the mix, Ishmael. And what's the promise and blessing that the Lord adapts his plan with to take care and bless Hagar because he cares about her and all of her descendants, because her descendants are also who else's descendants? Abram's. And he's already made the promise to Abram, I'm going to bless your descendants. So now Ishmael's and his descendants get blessed. Says you're going to have 12 princes among your children of Ishmael. And they're going to be great. And then he tells Abram, you're going to have a multitude of people as your descendants because of this circumstance. But what's the price of God's protection here with Hagar? Pregnant Hagar sitting at the well. She's got to go do what? She's got to go back to Sarai and submit and wait for all this to unfold. Not easy, is it? Is that the first time that God has asked women to do tough things with their kids as part of this plan? Well, I'll tell you one thing. I guarantee it didn't get past Moses' thoughts. When he thought about this, he had to think about his mom. Here is slave Hagar who's going to take this child, Ishmael, deliver it, and give it to Sarai so that Ishmael, under the Sarai solution, can be the child that's chosen to fulfill Abram's blessings and plans. Do you remember Jochebed? Who was Jochebed? Fast forward a little bit, a few hundred years, 400. Moses' mother. What did Jochebed have to do? She had to give up her baby and then submit to the woman and call that woman my baby's mother and help raise that child in the house of Pharaoh. And that's how Moses was raised. Do you think the slave Jochebed had any issues with submission during those years, raising her own child as another woman's son? That's the situation that Moses was born into. Hagar had to make that situation with Sarai into a reality. Very similar situation. We have a passage here, Philippians 1 and verse 29. We have been granted to suffer on his behalf. That's a gift. That is a gift. We get to suffer. And sometimes submission involves suffering. Chris.
I think probably both women would have been willing to suffer those indignities on behalf of their children. Had Hagar stayed where she was, both she and the child would have died. But a mother will do for her child whatever it takes.
It is amazing the strength and what women will do for their children. Thank God that he has put that in place instead of the male. I would have eaten my children a long time ago. Okay? Like in nature happens, where, you know, you don't see what is unique among men and women in raising of humans. That's not very common. It is seen, but it is not as common as you would think it would be in nature among animals, right? Oftentimes the male seeks to do what? Destroy the family unit so he can be all about what? Procreating some more. But that's not the situation here because the women are involved, okay? And so evidently, Hagar returns. Hagar returns back to the Sarai solution, and this continues for how long? The Sarai solution stays in place. How many years? 13 years go by between chapter 16 and chapter 17. So for 13 years, Abram has accepted the Sarai solution that Ishmael's going to be the child, because he hasn't heard from the Lord anything different. For 13 years, this child is raised in his tents as his son. And you know what? Abram grows to love this boy. He loves Ishmael. And we're going to see that clearly in chapter 17. But before we get into 17, let's look at the rest of 16 and see if there's anything anybody else wants to add. Let me add one more thing about this well. The well that Hagar has the angel appear to her at is called Beer Lehi Roy, which means the well of the living one who sees me. Hagar thought nobody cared about her. She reaches this well, this oasis, and after the conversation with the angel, she recognizes and she grows. She has a progression moment. And she names this well after the living one who sees me. And that's a beautiful thought. God sees us in our problems, doesn't he? He absolutely does. When you think nobody cares, you might be right. Nobody may care on this planet. But I'll tell you one thing. The Lord cares. And that's my walk away from desperate Hagar, the Egyptian slave. He cared about her. And he turns and pronounces blessings upon her child. All right, let's look at some lessons for Israel now. What are some walkaways that are important for Israel to learn from 16? You're at Mount Sinai. Moses receives this message, gets it all written down, and he gives it to the children of Israel for then and also in their years of wandering. They become familiar with this. What's the lessons for Israel? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they could relate to this, couldn't they? They could relate to Hagar, couldn't they? Mm-hmm. Now, what's the problem with relating to Hagar if you're a Jew? If you're a Hebrew, I should say. Right? Did they consider Ishmael a Hebrew? Abram is the one that's called the Hebrew. So naturally, all of his descendants should also be Hebrews, right? Mm-hmm. Right, unless you're a Hebrew, a Jewish Hebrew, right? One that came out of Egyptian bondage, because what did they want to be? We're of the chosen. Because, see they have the benefit of knowing the stories after chapter 16. They know what happens with Isaac, right? We haven't got to him yet. And so they have put themselves on a pedestal to be more special than Ishmael and his descendants. But isn't it ironic? Egyptian slavery brought Hagar and Ishmael about. And Egyptian slavery is what brought Israel as a nation all about. Okay. So did the Jews have a right to think of themselves more highly than any other descendants of Abram? No, that's an and that's an important point for them to understand. What else? Anything else kind of stir around with you, Larry?
Well, when God makes provisions, we should stay within those provisions. But they decided that maybe a king would be better than having a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll come up, even though God let them have this provision, as here. It definitely did not work out very well for them in the long run.
That's right. That's a good one. All right, let's talk for just a minute about chapter 16, lessons for the church, okay? The secondary, wider audience for what's in Genesis chapter 16. What do we learn from this? What's a walk away? God keeps his promises. He understood that he'd made a promise to Abram about his descendants, and then Ishmael's situation has to be dealt with. And God is true to his word, isn't he? That's a good one. What else? What does God show us by caring about Ishmael? Does he care about other nations and other peoples other than the children of Israel? Yes, he does. From the very beginning, he has shown, actually through every chapter up to this point, he has shown he loves mankind and wants a relationship with mankind, not just the children of Israel. And he cared about other nations. And he, in fact, gave this covenant of blessing to Ishmael and says, you're going to have a multitude of nations as your descendants. And they're going to be blessed. Blessed by who? Blessed by God. God cares about all mankind. What we have in the Bible, in the Old Testament, is the story of how he interrelated with these people, the Israelites. Okay? But God cares and has always cared about all men. Now, how does that affect what we read over in Mark chapter 16, verse 15 and 16? What we commonly call the Great Commission. Go ye into all the world and do what? To who? Just the special people? The whole world. Edify those who become disciples only? Don't worry about the rest? No. The whole world. So if we're going to mimic the characteristic of God in how he loves man, how should we approach our effort and our works if we're going to be like him and be Christ-like and God-like? No respecter of persons comes to mind, doesn't it? Well, that's what this looks like. Okay. I think those are good lessons that we need to apply when we get out of 16. All right, let's look at 17 in the few minutes we have remaining. We won't take time to read this chapter. It's not super long. It's 27 verses, but there's some key things in this chapter. And I'll tell you, this is interesting to me. When we get into chapter 17, we get new names. Finally, I don't have to stumble across, oh, I said Abraham, I shouldn't have. His name's not Abraham yet, it's Abram. Oh, I slipped up and said Sarah. Her real name is Sarai, and she doesn't become Sarah until Genesis chapter 17. This chapter really needs a title. And I'm going to give you a title. Remember what your name is. That's my title for Genesis chapter 17, because that's what my daddy always told me. Anytime I left the house on a date, when I went to college, when I went to school, when he was around early in the morning, he'd say, as I was walking out the door, Martin, remember what your name is. Well, you know what? I know what my dad meant by that. Don't bring shame upon me or my family or your mother or your grandmothers or anybody else who has the last name Adams. Behave yourself. We have certain standards. Don't break them. Have a nice day. That's what my dad meant. Let me tell you, God puts great significance when he changes people's names. Okay? So let's chew on that a bit. We see in Genesis chapter 17 that Abram gets a new name. And this is now 13 years later after what we just talked about in chapter 16. So 16's happened. Flashpoint, curtain drops. New scene, new act comes along. 13 years later would go across the screen if we were watching all this in a movie. 13 years later, dot, dot, dot. chapter 17 happens. All right, Abram gets this new name. Verses 1 through 8, I'd say we want to read that, but if we look at verses 1 through 8, what we see here, again, is a reiteration of this promise made to Abram. And it says, again, I'm going to make a covenant with you. I will multiply you exceedingly, he says. And Abram fell on his face, and God says, my covenant is with you. I will make you a father of a multitude of nations. He's expanded that now because of Ishmael. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but now you shall be called Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. Kings will come forth from you, and I will establish this covenant between me and you forever, and it will be an everlasting possession, this land of Canaan. And there's another covenant I'm going to make with you, and I'm going to add to you in this point. And Abraham says, well, what is it, Lord? And starting in verse 9 through about verse 14, okay, 9 through 14, we have the introduction of another covenant. Remember, we said one of the major themes in Genesis was it's a book of covenants. Here's another one. And this is the covenant of what? Circumcision. How important is this covenant of circumcision in the future for Israel rolling down through time? How is this just one of these minor things that just never shows up again? Oh, no. This covenant of circumcision becomes the defining physical characteristic difference between Jews, or children of Israel, and Gentiles. Does it get to be a problem in the church? Oh, yes. Paul even gets to the point of being deriding about individuals that are holding to this covenant of circumcision as being necessary for salvation within the church, because he calls it the covenant of what? Not circumcision, but they are what? Of the mutilation or concision, I think the King James uses. So instead of circumcision, he uses this play on words of concision, this idea of not just cutting off the foreskin, but rather hacking the whole thing off. Okay, just to be blunt in an adult way, that's what Paul says there about being the concision. They're brethren of mutilation. Okay, this is not going to go away. This is an extremely important covenant that is given to Abraham. And you know, we talked about what Hagar had to do in order to submit to get the blessings. Abram is how old here? He's 99 years old, and he's going to submit to circumcision. Okay? And not only he is, but Ishmael also is. And he's how old? 13. Okay? And who else has to do this? Every male in the entire household of Abram or Abraham is part of this. And so, in Genesis chapter 17, what happens? They perform it. In one day, it's all done. Now, I have to say, there's probably not a whole lot else that happened that week around the household of Abraham. Okay? But he took it upon himself to submit. Was that easy? Was that something you'd like really want to do? I would testify to that. No. Okay? Not the type of thing I would do. But on the fifth day of every child's birth, male child, from that point on, they were to circumcise on the fifth day. And it becomes one of the most religiously held, steadfastly observed covenants that God ever made with Israel, with the children of Israel. And so this is where it comes from. And so Moses gives this to Israel as a reminder of this new name now. But it represents, this name change represents this limited covenant that God has made with man, specifically with this man, okay? Was this covenant for all mankind in Genesis 17? Absolutely not. It's for who? The household of Abraham. That's who got this covenant. Not all mankind. Some covenants are unlimited with God. Remember the flood? That was a covenant. He was not going to ever destroy the world again with water, right? That was a covenant, unlimited. This one is limited. It was limited in its institution, very clearly. Larry?
They're circumcised the eighth day.
What did I say? Fifth day? Eighth day. Sorry. Edit that out. Okay, eighth day. You're right. All right, and so we see that instituted here. And then we have an interesting thing. In verse 15, God comes back to Abraham and says, oh, and besides these blessings and all this about the land and descendants and so forth, this time next year, you're going to have a child with Sarai. And what does Abraham do? Not just laughs, he does what? He fell down busting up laughing in this conversation with God. It says he fell down laughing as he talked to the Lord about this. Now, I don't know many people that have gotten away with laughing at what God told them. So how this happened, I don't think involved disbelief in a way that would be condescending or show irreverence to God. I just don't see that coming from Abraham here. But the fact of the matter is, Abraham knew, I'm 99, and I've just been circumcised. Okay? The last thing I want to think about is this time next year, a child will be born. And he knows how old Sarah is. And she's how old? She's 90. And he knows this is not going to happen through natural processes. And think about this for a minute. Isn't that the entire point? It could not have happened through natural processes. And God was waiting for 13 years for this Sarai solution to play itself out and then interject his solution so that there would be no misunderstanding that this came from me, because it couldn't have happened any other way. That Isaac was the chosen one, and he came from me to you. That's where God's going with this. Okay? And so Abraham laughs at what God says to him. And so God comes back to Abraham and says, you know, no, it will in fact happen. It will happen. And he says, and Sarah, who is 90, will bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Remember what I said a few minutes ago? Abraham loved Ishmael. It was his son. He'd gotten used to this Sarai solution. He kind of liked it. All that drama in the years before, when all this first got laid into place, is probably, you know, long in the rearview mirror. Things are going pretty good in his household. And he loves Ishmael. Oh, that you would use Ishmael in this plan. And what does God say? What does God say? I'm taking care of Ishmael. He will be blessed. But no, Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you will call his name Isaac. And I will establish the covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And he says, verse 20, you know, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him, and I will make him fruitful and multiply him exceedingly. Okay? So he's going to take care of Ishmael. But Ishmael is not part of God's plan. He's part of that Sarai solution. And God says no to that. All right. And so now we see that Sarah in Genesis chapter 17, she gets a new name too. From Sarai, her name now will be what? Sarah, thankfully, because now I can know how to pronounce it. Her name will be Sarah. So Abraham and Sarah now are going to receive this child of promise. beginning in verse, in the next chapter over here, well, 18, he's specifically promised again. And we're going to see, in chapter 18, we're going to see somebody else that laughs about this. But this is what occurred with the Lord, and Sarah gets a new name. And why does God change their name here? Why doesn't he wait till the child's born, for example? I don't necessarily have an answer to that in my head, so y'all give me one. Why would God say, in connection with the covenant of circumcision, his pronouncement, and tying with that, his pronouncement directly to Abraham about Sarah and him having a son, and his name will be Isaac, and he changes their names? Why is that significant? Why would God do it and do it here? Any thoughts?
What's God going to make of them? What the interaction with God and his promises will bring.
Okay. Think for a minute. I agree with that. Absolutely. This is a defining moment, is when these kind of things happen. And I'll give you the next example. Do you remember when Jacob's name was changed to Israel? What does Jacob mean, by the way? Do you remember? Anybody remember? What does it mean?
Supplanter.
The deceiver, the shyster is the idea, okay? The supplanter. Somebody who takes something from somebody else and does something with it. And, you know, they're a taker, not a giver. They're a supplanter. But there was an occasion where Jacob got his name changed to Israel. And what was that occasion? What he just spent the whole night doing? Wrestling with the angel of the Lord. And he was so tenacious about it that he held on until dawn. Got a busted hip from it, right? Or one thrown out of joint, at least. But at that moment, when he was entering back into the land of Canaan, emphasis on the land again, is where this occurred. And so when Jacob re-enters the land with his new family after years away under Laban, he re-enters the land and he becomes Israel. That's significant. How about this in the New Testament? Jesus said to Simon, "You are Simon. You will be Peter from that day forward." Somebody turn over, Joe, turn over and read for me Revelation 2, verse 17. Christians were called, I'm sorry, the disciples were first called Christians, a new name, in Antioch in the book of Acts. Another significant name change that God provided. Old Testament prophecy definitely tells us it was a God-provided name. Read Revelation 2:17, Joe.
"He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written on it, which no one knows except him who receives it."
Who's going to get a new name? Who else is going to get a new name? According to Revelation 2:17. Those that overcome. That's you and me. We have a name of Christian now, but when we overcome, the Lord's going to give us a new place to live. He's going to give you a new body, and he's going to give you a new name. I get goosebumps thinking about that. I want to start packing my suitcase. That's a very significant, important thing to tie together. And this passage in Genesis chapter 17 is something we ought to think back about. Because look what's involved in this name change with Abraham. A new land, new way, new nation, families being blessed, relationship with God is being chosen and special. All of that is wrapped up in this name change. And we're going to be promised, we are promised, according to John's revelation, that we're going to receive that too. Okay. So Abraham or Abram, come here. I've got a new name for you. See how you like this. And you can just see Abraham's faith blossoming and growing. Because in the next chapter, we're going to see him do some tremendously great things with his relationship with God as well. Okay. So what's happening in the last part of chapter 17? This Sarai solution is being, it's run its course. It's being put away. Abraham was satisfied with it, but he moves from being this father of a great nation to father of a multitude of nations because of this inclusion of Ishmael. But Israel is being reminded here that they have relatives among the Arab nations. They should set aside these attitudes of elitism. They don't have a right to feel that. God has chosen them not because they're special in some more righteous way, but they are serving his plan. Okay? God is very much concerned about other nations. All right, conclusion here. Oops, that didn't roll. Sorry. There. Conclusion here. 13 years or so represented here are so important to understanding what will follow. We can take great comfort in seeing the long-suffering of God and also the knowledge that people progress as they grow spiritually, as they walk with God every day. And we should be getting better every day. Abraham and Sarah clearly have been growing. And they're going to continue to grow, we're going to see. It took time for Abram and Sarai to be ready for their new names. They are not perfect, but they are being perfected, just like us today through Jesus Christ and his word. We're being perfected for that new name that John refers to in Revelation. Okay, thoughts or comments on 16 or 17? As I said, there's a lot here for us. In these sections and passages that give us great lessons to kind of pull the thread of this great tapestry out a little bit. Comments? Joe?
I kind of thought it was interesting, like in chapter 15 and even after when Isaac is born, it's just God reiterating, like at the end of 15, he does this display of the covenant that he's making. And then changes their name for another sign of the covenant. And then again with the circumcision, it's just interesting that God just keeps using signs to reiterate his covenant that he's making with Abraham.
It is. You wonder sometimes, how many times did he have to tell Abraham he was going to get this land and he was going to be blessed with all these descendants and be so mighty? How many times have we read that now? I don't know, 4 or 5 at least, right? Through these chapters, that some variation of this promise and this covenant has been given. Well, that tells me when the Lord repeats something that many times, it is extremely important, right? And for the primary audience of Israel to be motivated as to who says we can have this land? Well, God has said it. God told Abraham he could have it over and over and over again. And we're the ones that are supposed to go get it. So come on, gang. Let's get our act together and go take the land. You can almost hear Joshua referring back to this. This is what God told us to do. This is what he expects us to do from the time of Abraham onward. That's good. They're going to need motivation for that. It's a courageous thing they were asked to do. What else? Anything else come out from anybody? Okay, we will look at chapter 18 and 19 next week. 18 and 19, and so read those as you if you have a chance this next week to move on and to read that before you come in, because we're going to talk about another aspect of Abraham's life where he has to make some hard choices, but he's prepared for those choices, and he's prepared for that conversation that he's going to have with God, and it's going to be about Sodom and Gomorrah, people that he has rescued in the past. Kings and relations that he, and acquaintances perhaps that he knows, and family is involved, which can always skew a righteous person into doing really unrighteous things. Blood being thicker than water sometimes causes people to do things they ought not to do. But we're going to see how Abraham handles that, and I think that's a great lesson for us. That's how does he handle Lot and the Sodom and Gomorrah episode. And so that's in 18 and 19. We'll read through that. And then we're going to see a little bit of digression into studying a little bit about Lot and his descendants will come up in this. Okay. Thank you for your time and attention tonight.